The following ABC News podcast is brought to you by Verizon Online DFL.
This week, the war debate rips Congress apart.
The House will be in order.
Cowards cut and run. Marines never do.
Those gravestones don't say Democrat or Republican. They say American.
President Bush from Asia joins the fray.
We will stay in the fight until we have achieved the victory that our brave troops have fought for.
But do we have a strategy for victory? When can our troops come home? And what does the political battle in Washington mean for the ground war in Iraq? We'll ask our headliner, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. On our roundtable, Time Magazine's Joe Klein joins Martha Raddatz, Fareed Zakaria, and George Will to debate this week's rough-and-tumble politics. Plus, in his last week on Nightline, Ted Koppel looks back.
It was a terribly awkward question, but there was no way of doing that particular interview without asking it.
And as always, the Sunday Funny.
By the way, President Bush is on an eight-day tour of Asia. He's visiting American jobs.
From ABC News in Washington, this week with George Stephanopoulos.
Good morning, everyone. It has been a week of bitter charge and countercharge on Iraq. So today we're going straight to the man in charge of the Pentagon effort, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Welcome back to This Week, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, George.
And let's begin with Congressman Murtha, 30-year veteran of the House, decorated Marine, leading defense Democrat. He came out this week and said it was time to begin redeploying U.S. forces out of Iraq.
Congress is charged with sending our sons and daughters into battle. And it's our responsibility, our obligation, to speak out for them. That's why I'm speaking out. Our military's done everything that has been asked of them. The U.S. cannot accomplish anything further in Iraq militarily. It's time to bring the troops home.
What do you say to Congressman Murtha?
Well, you know, if you think back, we had similar debates during World War II, during Korea, during Vietnam. It's always been so, and it's understandable because these are important subjects. They ought to be discussed and debated. I think one way to answer the question, however, is to put yourself in the shoes of other people. Put yourself in the shoes of the Iraqis. Put yourself in the shoes of the insurgents, the terrorists. What do they see in all this? What they clearly see is that if they wait, they prevail, and they'll be able to turn that country into a haven for terrorists. Put yourself in the shoes of the American soldiers who are losing lives and losing limbs, and believe that it is a noble cause, which it is, believe they're making progress, believe we will prevail. And so we have to all have the willingness to have a free debate, but we also have to have the willingness to understand what the effects of our words are.
Let me get in right there, because Congressman Murtha says he is speaking out for the American soldiers. And as you know, he's very closely tied to the military, to the uniformed military. Do you believe that he does represent a faction of the military that is making exactly the same argument?
Well, you know, with 1.4 million men and women in uniform and another million retirees, you can find people all across the spectrum who have views.
How about the top levels of the military?
Well, the top levels of the military are the people who report to the president and to me, and we know what they're saying. They're saying that we believe we're making progress, that they believe that we are passing over responsibility to the Iraqi security forces. They've turned over something like 17 bases within the last period of months. They've turned over a province. They've turned over major portions of Baghdad. The Iraqi security forces are now up to 212,000. And clearly, the American military plan and strategy is to do just that.
They say they're up to 212,000, but only about 700 are now prepared to take the battle alone. Isn't that correct?
Oh, George, that is a red herring that people have been flopping around here for weeks.
Is it true or not?
Of course, it's not true. The way to look at it, the way to put it in perspective, the way to give your listeners an accurate perception of it is that the Iraqis are losing about twice the number of coalition forces. They are out engaged in the fight. They're all across the country providing security for the Iraqi people. They've got over 100 battalions that are functioning in one way or another.
But in one way or another isn't actually important. The way I understand the numbers, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there are 700 troops that are prepared to fight on their own, something over 20,000 who can take the lead in a battle but need to be heavily supported by U.S. forces, and that the rest need to have the United States forces take the lead. Is that true or not?
Most of our forces need support. Most of NATO forces need support. The comparison you're casting is clearly confusing to the listener. The fact of the matter is that the Iraqi security forces are out engaged in the fight. Some are in the lead. Some are working with us in tandem. Others are working with us where we have the lead. And that is perfectly understandable. That's the same thing we're doing in Afghanistan with coalition forces.
James Fallows, the Atlantic Monthly's lead national correspondent, has a cover story this week saying why Iraq has no army. And I want to read to our listeners something of what he said after examining this issue with many members of the military over the last couple of months. He says, if the United States is serious about getting out of Iraq, it will need to spend money for interpreters. It will need to create large new training facilities for American troops. It will need to commit air, logistics, medical, and intelligence services to Iraq and understand that this is a commitment for years, not a temporary measure. It will need to decide that there are weapon systems it does not require and commitments it cannot afford if it is to support the ones that are crucial, and it will need to make these decisions in a matter of months, not years, before it's too late. Is the United States prepared to make those kind of investments, that kind of commitment, and that kind of sacrifice?
I haven't read the article. I have no idea what he's talking about. But the idea that we need vast new training for American forces, which is what you said, I just don't know what it means.
And new interpreters, and he says new
interpreters. Our country has a deficiency in language capability. It starts in school, and it continues throughout our lives, and it's unfortunate. And we would be vastly better off if we had significantly improved language capabilities. And we are in the process of making decisions that are moving funds from one area into language competence and capability.
But is he right when he says that unless we're prepared to make this robust commitment, make sacrifices in other areas, we should either be ready to make this commitment of years, and he does say years, or be prepared to come home?
I haven't read the article, George.
Address the argument.
The argument is that the United States has a plan. They have a strategy. They are implementing that. They have trained over 212,000 Iraqi security forces. People who denigrate their competence and their capability are flat wrong. They're making a mistake. They either don't understand the situation or they're trying to confuse it. But the Iraqi security forces are well respected by the Iraqi people. They're doing a very good job. They're growing in numbers. They're growing in competence. We have people embedded with them and have the ability now to know what their strengths and weaknesses are, what kind of equipment they need, and be able to help them get that equipment more rapidly. If they see disconnects between the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army, we're able to see that and get that fixed. If there's a disconnect between the Iraqi army and the intelligence competence that's needed, we're able to see that. In the last few months, because of this, we have seen the number of tips that come in go from 400 into 1,000. And that is impressive.
General Casey, there are several reports that General Casey has submitted a plan to you that envisions the possibility of withdrawing up to 60,000 troops from Iraq by the end of next year, if conditions warrant. Have you signed that plan?
The President has said, General Casey has said, I have said repeatedly what the arrangements are. And the arrangements are that the passover of responsibility to the Iraqis will be condition-based. It will depend on what takes place on the ground. General Casey has the responsibility of planning, looking forward and saying, if the conditions are these, what might we do? Now, we currently have about 159,000 troops in Iraq. We plan to bring that down to about 138,000
after
the election, which has been our baseline. We're bulked up right now because of the elections coming up December 15th. And incidentally, the elections are an amazing thing if you think about it. The Iraqis now have their own constitution. They're going to be electing people under that constitution in 1 month, December 15th. And be able to put in place a government for a period of years.
Well, that is true, sir. But we've seen elections over the last year. We saw elections in January. We saw the referendum on the Constitution in October. Yet, in the face of that political progress, the insurgency doesn't seem to have waned. The number of attacks each week has gone up.
The number of attacks each week have not gone up. What we're seeing is increasing lethality in the attacks that have occurred. But the number of attacks have fluctuated, and as a matter of fact, I think they were somewhat less during the referendum on the Constitution than they were during the January
election.
Although
October was the fourth most lethal month for American forces in Iraq, but I don't want to get bogged down on that. I'm trying to get a sense of what are the conditions that can lead to withdrawal. For example, if...
Well, let me tell you what they are. They put together teams of people between the embassy in Iraq, the military in Iraq, and the Iraqi government. And they are working out what those conditions are. And as a result, they on each week, additional responsibility is passed off to Iraqis in various parts of the country. It's not going to be in one fell swoop. But as that happens, obviously we're going to be able to move down the numbers of coalition forces because the total number of Iraqi security forces is going up faster. And we're going to have more security. We have more security forces there today, every day, every week, and we will continue to have more, even though the coalition numbers will come down over the period ahead.
Senator McCain still said this week that he believes about 10,000 more troops are needed on the ground in Iraq, U.S. troops on the ground in Iraq right now. And it's reopened, I think, this two-year-old debate on whether we had enough troops on the ground right after the invasion. I want to show you what former Secretary of State Colin Powell said about that this week.
Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of the war, that part of the war, I think we made mistakes. I think we made mistakes by not being able to impose order on the whole country. I don't think we had enough troops to do that.
Is Secretary Powell right?
Well, the idea that you could have imposed order on that country is a big order. It is a country that takes... The only thing that imposed order on it over time was a vicious dictatorship that put hundreds of thousands of people into mass graves.
Well, several said, though, that 300,000 troops could have done it. Do you believe that?
We'll never know. We'll never know. What we do know is that the battlefield commanders believed they had the right number, recommended that number, and that number was approved. I think they were correct. I personally believe they were correct, but we'll never know the answer to that question.
Now, this debate does continue. Time magazine just this morning has another report talking about a meeting that Republican Senator John Warner, Chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Carl Levin, and Senator Mark Dayton, had with 10 military officers this week. And it goes on to report that according to two sources with knowledge of the meeting, the Army and Marine officers were blunt. In contrast to the Pentagon's stock answer that there are enough troops on the ground in Iraq, the commander said that they not only needed more manpower, but also repeatedly asked for it. Indeed, military sources told Time that as recently as August 2005, a senior military official requested more troops but got turned down flat. True?
No one's ever been turned down by me. The troops that have been asked for have been given. Is it possible that some commander at some location in some part of that country went to General Vines or General Casey and said, gee, I need more troops for this, and they made allocation decisions within the country? It's entirely possible. Is it correct to suggest that General Vines or General Casey or General Abizaid have ever asked for more troops and been turned down? That is flat not true.
You know, what has been happening as we debate the number of troops, as we debate whether to withdraw, is also this continual debate over the intelligence leading up to the war. And I know you said you believe that it's wrong to question the motives or the honesty of administration officials, but I have a different question for you. If you had known that no weapons of mass destruction would be found, would you have advocated invasion?
I didn't advocate invasion.
You didn't?
No, I wasn't asked. If you read all the books and the things...
You weren't, but why weren't you asked? That's very puzzling.
Well, I'm sure the president understood what my views were, but as a technical matter, did he ever look and say, what should we do? Should we go do this or not do that? This is something that the president thought through very carefully.
Are you trying to distance yourself from the war with that?
Of course not. I agreed completely with the decision to go to war. And said that 100 times. And don't even suggest that.
I'm just asking.
Yeah, well, you know better. Look, the interesting thing to me about the pre-war intelligence is clearly it was wrong. It was wrong, but everyone saw the same thing in the executive branch and the legislative branch and other countries that was presented at the UN.
But would you have been for an invasion if we had known that?
The answer is Probably yes. And they were, our planes were being shot at every day, every week, in the no-fly zones. Here was a man who was giving $125,000 to the families of suicide killers, murderers who were doing it. Zarqawi was in that country during that period. He's a person who'd used chemical weapons against his own people and against his neighbors, had invaded Kuwait. The world will be vastly better off with Saddam Hussein gone and with the democratic system in that country. And I think the kind of rehashing and suggesting that there was anything manipulative about the intelligence is really a great disservice to the country.
Let me turn now to the issue of torture and whether the United States has condoned torture. As you know, Senator...
We haven't. There isn't a question as to whether we have or not. We haven't.
Okay. That's good to hear, first of all.
The President said there will be humane treatment of prisoners. All the instructions I issued required humane treatment. And anything that was done that was not humane has been prosecuted.
Yes, Senator John McCain has added an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill, the one that funds the Pentagon, that would make it clear that the U.S. doesn't condone torture. It says all interrogators must abide by the Army Field Manual, and then goes on to say that no individual in the custody or under the physical control of the United States government, regardless of nationality or physical location, shall be subject to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. This passed 90-9 in the Senate.
And the President has said that.
And he's threatened to veto the bill over this provision. Why?
Well, I'm not sure you're correct. I think
I'm pretty sure I'm correct. And there's been a lot of negotiations going on.
There's discussion and debate taking place as to what the implications might be and what is supportable and what is not. But the fact of the matter is the President from the outset has said that he required that there be humane treatment.
But what's wrong with that language? Because again, the idea of that is that conciliation should not be exempted.
There have been about three versions of this. There are discussions and debates going on by the White House with the Senate, and I think that's the appropriate place to leave it.
And you're not involved in those negotiations?
Not really. We are supporting the White House in what they're doing, and we are the ones that have the field manual and have been working that and issuing that as soon as it's appropriate. But the history of the United States military is clear. Torture doesn't work. The military knows that. We want our people treated humanely. We have required that the behavior of our folks be that they treat prisoners humanely. They have overwhelmingly treated people humanely. And the photographs that came out of the night shift at Abu Ghraib, the implication that that is a pattern or a standard or a permitted in some way, is just false and wrong and harmful to the country, no question.
It has hurt the country.
Oh, you bet your life it has. And it's most unfortunate because it leaves a totally inaccurate impression that is something that was permitted. Those people have been prosecuted and put in jail.
General John Abizaid, the commanding general of Central Command, recently told the Senate that we're not yet organized to the extent we need to be to fight al-Qaeda and win the global war on terror. Why not?
Well, it's complicated, but he's certainly right, and I think most people understand that.
It's pretty scary, though.
Well, what you have is a group of congressional committees that have jurisdictions and subcommittees, and suddenly we're in a new era. We're in the world of post-September 11th. It's not Vietnam. It's not the Cold War. It's a new period where we have not nation states for the most part that we have to deal with, but networks and terrorists, individual terrorists and groups of terrorists, hidden funding, movement of people across borders illegally. And it requires a totally different organization and arrangement and approach, and it's tough. And a lot of people have their mindsets stuck back in the Cold War or back in Vietnam.
And what is that costing us?
Oh, come on now. How would one know? What throughout history, you constantly have to adapt. And when you have big institutions and big bureaucracies and a Congress and a free press, you do not turn on a dime. You simply don't. Now, the terrorists can turn inside of our decision cycle quite easily. But the task is to constantly move our bureaucracies and our government and our thinking and the media's thinking and the public's thinking to understand that we're in a global war on terror. We're up against people who are determined to reestablish a caliphate in this world. who are determined to go out and kill innocent men, women, and children, and they're doing it almost every single day. They're raising money to do it. They're recruiting people to do it. And it's going to take a concerted effort over a sustained period of time for free people to fully understand the nature of that threat and to fully deal with the nature of that threat.
Mr. Secretary, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for coming back to This Week.
Thank you.
And we are back now with the roundtable. I am joined, as always, by George Will, Joe Klein of Time Magazine. Welcome back to Fareed Zakaria of Newsweek International. And welcome back to Martha Raddatz, former Pentagon correspondent, new White House correspondent for ABC News. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I think.
That's what everybody says.
Let's obviously begin with Iraq. I mean, we all saw that debate explode Friday night in the House of Representatives. Congressman Murtha, defense Democrat, comes out and says it's time to bring the troops home now. We've heard Secretary Rumsfeld's response. We have to stay the course. But Joe Klein, what I want to get to is a slightly broader question. It really did feel like the entire debate, at least here in Washington, shifted this week.
Oh, yeah. It shifted from a debate about how to prosecute the war to how to leave it. And I think that it was fairly extreme in the House, but the vote in the Senate was probably more significant and more reflective.
Hey, explain what that vote was.
It was a resolution. The Democrats offered wording for a phased withdrawal from Iraq, and that went down, but then 79 senators voted for better reporting from the Bush administration and a strategy that would turn over sovereignty in the war to Iraq in 2006.
And they must have felt they needed to draft that resolution because they were afraid they were going to lose Republicans on the Democrats' more stringent call for withdrawal.
And also, everybody's feeling dismay about this. I mean, they're feeling, you know, there's a people read the polls. And they understand that the public has lost faith in the effort. It's a big problem for a lot of politicians. You're going to hear it going home.
Was this a political tipping point?
I'm not sure. We are conducting an imperial foreign policy. That is, since 9/11, the American policy has been that our national well-being depends upon many projections of power far from our shore for protracted periods of time to affect substantial changes in the world. Now, this is what empire looks like, what we're seeing on television. And the question is, can a modern democracy with instant graphic journalism conduct this kind of foreign policy? And if this was a tipping point, we began to answer no today.
I think there's a related issue, which is, in general, Americans lose faith in wars in about a year and a half unless they are clearly winning, unless we are clearly winning.
And the numbers you're seeing now are very similar to the numbers you saw in Vietnam in 1970.
Exactly. In Vietnam and in Korea, by the way. The question for the administration is they have to come up with some metric that they can show some kind of progress. If you look at attacks, if you look at successive attacks, if you look at electricity production, if you look at oil production, none of these show any substantial shift over a year ago. And I think for the administration, they need to be able to show there's some kind of progress. Otherwise, you have a kind of tragedy in the making here where the military is adopting a clear and hold strategy, which requires a lengthy period of engagement in Iraq.
But the Fallows Road.
As Fallows Road, that you actually need a stronger presence, whether or not you need more troops. You need a commitment to Iraq. But the political process is at this very moment moving in a very different direction than the military.
And the military may be as well moving in that different direction.
Well, I think if you talk to troops on the ground, which I did about 3 weeks ago back when I was Pentagon correspondent, if you talk to troops on the ground, they say, you've got to stay the course, you've got to stay the course. But they're thinking tactically. They see fellow Marines, fellow soldiers being killed over there. They want to make this work. But I do think this struck a chord this week. I don't think a lot of people are saying, yeah, let's pull out now. But people are doing exactly what Fareed said. They're saying, look, what are we still doing there? What's the measure of progress? You look all the time over there now, though, and every sign points to the fact, whether they say it or not, that we are about to draw down over there. They've got some brigades on hold that were supposed to go over there in December. They're not going over there. Commanders have been looking at this and planning this for a long time because they have to draw down.
The thing is that there have been two realities here. There's been the rhetorical reality of the Bush administration, which is you know, the imperial strategy that George was talking about. But the military reality has been entirely different. This war has been an orphan since the day after we arrived in Baghdad. It hasn't been fought by the civilian leadership of the Pentagon. You know, Secretary Rumsfeld has been far more
distancing himself.
Yeah, right. He's been far more interested in the transformation of the military and in procurement issues and how we're going to face down the Chinese than he has been in peacekeeping operations. Today in the New York Times, it was reported that the Pentagon is finally going to raise stability operations, peacekeeping, to the same level as combat. That's the world that we're in now, a world where we have to really get good
at
peacekeeping.
And the American people aren't connected to this war. I mean, we have so many troops over there, 150,000, 155 right now, 138,000 normally, but there's no real connection to the average American. The administration hasn't really wanted Americans to think about this war, and they haven't. That's why this week was...
Well, they're divided. They keep saying, we're at war, remember, we're at war, this is serious, but there's no domestic echo of the war. There's no policy. There's no tax. There's nothing.
There's also no sense that it is the most important thing going on that the United States is doing.
That's what's changing right now, though. I mean, I think you see the White House now sees by it, and the country certainly does appear to be...
But the problem is it's not a PR problem, George, which is... There's a real substantive policy issue. Who is running the Iraq war?
Who is?
It's not clear, right? I mean, Rumsfeld was a potted plant on the show. He says he has nothing to do with troop levels. He didn't actually advocate the invasion. He doesn't have anything to do with the negotiations about the torture bill. He's not doing it. The Secretary of State, Bondi Rice, is out.
The President, even this week, said, so long as I'm Commander-in-Chief, our strategy in Iraq will be driven by the sober judgment of our military commanders on the ground. The military is supposed to be run by civilians. They execute policy.
But the fundamental question is no longer the military one, because what Mr. Rumsfeld said to George was, yes, it's a good idea we've gone to war because the world's going to be better off, A, without Saddam, a sufficient reason for going to war, and B, a second sufficient reason, with a democracy up and running. Now, building democracies is not peacekeeping, the phrase you use. There's no peace to be kept. This is nation building. And conservatives, these are all conservatives, cannot believe in
and
that.
And let's not lose sight of what was happening on the ground in Iraq this week. And I want to talk to you, Fareed, about this. It really does look more and more every single day like a civil war. You have all these pictures of Sunnis who are tortured in the Iraqi prisons, and then the retaliation against Shiite mosques. And can we control this?
Well, the way I would put it, George, is actually it looks more and more like conditions for a civil war, which is to say what is remarkable is actually the absence of group-on-group fighting. But you're seeing all kinds of tensions, the torture. The most important thing I think you're seeing is a political process that is sharply dividing people in a pattern that has happened often. Elections actually sometimes draw people apart because Sunnis will vote for Sunnis, Shia will vote for Shia. There is one dynamic here that we don't know about, which is the election is going to be important. It's the first time you've had an election for a four-year Iraqi government. Until now, the Iraqi governments have been by almost design lame ducks. And the second part here is that it's the first time you're having Sunni participation. So I would be much more comfortable with this discussion of American strategy were to take place after December 15th. And we're having this discussion, you know, oddly because it's working well on our clock. But Iraq is about to have what could be a fairly significant event.
You know, one of the most hallucinatory moments of your interview with Rumsfeld was when he was talking about the hundreds of thousands of troops, you know, Iraqi troops around.
12,000.
I mean, we have a situation, the Ministry of Defense in Iraq, where they can't support the troops at all, where there's total incompetence there. The true figure is, as reported, about 700, and they tend to be, you know, militias, Peshmerga, Kurdish militia, and
but let's try to get to the bottom of this. This is tough, and I think it's got to be tough for people as well. If indeed it is true that the military is looking to withdraw almost no matter what, even though Secretary Rumsfeld says baseline conditions, and if it is indeed true that there are only 700 Iraqi forces, and they're probably part of an ethnic militia who are now capable of fighting, what does that mean, and I'll ask you, Fareed, the day after?
Well, I think what the military is hoping to do is modest withdrawals. I think there would be some withdrawals, but they're relatively modest. And the idea, as I understand it, is that we would be involved in holding difficult areas, training the military, but One of the things the military, and I spent a day and a half with John Avizé at CENTCOM this week, I think what they're trying to do is force the Iraqi military to take more responsibility. One of the problems we've had here is that the Iraqi government has not had real responsibility for the security of its country. So it's easy for them, for example, for the Shia-dominated government to say, we're never going to talk to the Sunnis or the Baathists. They're not losing people.
So then that puts the administration strategy on its head. They actually believe, at least the military commanders, that the Iraqi forces will stand up only if we stand down.
But there has to be some process of forced independence. But the most important thing here to realize is, I think, the crucial question that we really face is the one you raised, which is the political compact and the political stability of the country because of these three communities. That's the part we haven't gotten right. You know, we still have this happy talk about just talk about the foreign terrorists. That's not the problem in Iraq. The problem in Iraq is that you have a Baathist-led, Sunni-supported insurgency because they feel that they were shafted in the new Iraq.
You're talking about a modest pullout of troops, and if it's as many as 60,000, you're still talking about that during a time when the insurgency is raging over there in four provinces. And they talk about these four provinces. It's only four provinces. 2 years ago, when I first went into that country, they were talking about those same four provinces.
And 50% of the population.
Yes, 50%. And the Iraqi security forces, I've seen those security forces over and over again. There are some, they have definitely made progress over there. But they are riding around in small pickup trucks. If you leave, and you leave the support system of the American army, you are leaving them with much less capability than the U.S. forces have to fight this insurgency, and the U.S. forces have been unable to contain.
You know, I want to get on to Judge Alito. That debate also heated up this week. We found a 20-year-old job application where he was going for a promotion in the Reagan administration where he said, you know, I don't believe the Constitution protects the right to an abortion, and it created a firestorm of political ads on both sides.
Liberal groups led by the People for the American Way oppose Judge Alito's nomination to the Supreme Court. Their agenda is clear. They want to take God out of the Pledge of Allegiance and are fighting to redefine traditional marriage. They sanction the burning of the American flag, even partial birth abortion.
As a judge, Alito ruled to make it easier for corporations to discriminate. Even voted to approve the strip search of a 10-year-old girl. As a government lawyer, Alito wrote, the Constitution does not protect the right to an abortion. The right wing has already taken over the West Wing. Don't let them take over your Supreme Court.
Joe Klein, did that memo increase the chances that Judge Alito can be defeated, first of all, or secondly, and maybe these both go together, was it a trap for Democrats?
I don't know whether it was a trap for Democrats. I don't think it increased the chances he can be defeated. He's going to be confirmed, and you know he is obviously the memo showed what he is. He is a conservative. He is a very well respected and highly qualified conservative. And if Democrats don't like judges like this, they should start winning elections.
And Martha, I think that what I've heard from the people inside the White House, they think it is a trap for the Democrats. The Democrats are going to be sucked into a big debate over abortion, which is the last thing they need in an election year.
Exactly that, I believe. I mean, White House officials don't seem terribly concerned about this nomination. They feel it'll go through. I don't think the American people seem terribly engaged in this debate either, so I don't think there's a lot of sweating in the White House.
When he says the Constitution does not protect the right of abortion, he's saying what a great many conservatives and a great many liberals believe, which is that Roe v. Wade was sloppily argued and improperly decided, regardless of what you think social policy on abortion ought to be. But that, he wrote that 12 years after Roe v. Wade. It's now 33 years almost come January. And remember Rehnquist. Rehnquist made quite a career of opposing the Miranda decision, saying it was badly argued, bad social policy, terrible thing. Time finally came 30, 40 years later when he had a chance to overrule it, and he said, it is settled law. It is woven into the fabric of police dramas on television and American practice, and let it go.
And I think everyone does pretty much want to let it go at this point, but we're going to hear a lot about it at those hearings. Before we go, I want to turn to something else that everybody in Washington is buzzing about this week. Bob Woodward has another secret source, something he seemed to deny when he was on Larry King just before Patrick Fitzgerald announced his indictments.
I wish I did have a bombshell. I don't even have a firecracker. I'm sorry. In fact, this tells you something about what's the atmosphere here. I got a call from somebody in the CIA saying he got a call from the best New York Times reporter on this saying exactly that I supposedly had a bombshell.
Well, it is true that Bob Woodward did not have a story that he was prepared to write, but it's also true, we found out this week, that he was told by someone inside the administration that Mrs. Wilson worked at the CAA before Louis Libby had conversations with reporters. So he became, we think, the first reporter known to have had these conversations. Yet, Fareed Zakaria, we still don't know who the source is. He won't say who it is. And it's created this incredible game in Washington of, I'm not Spartacus. Every single administration official coming forward, Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, Pentagon Secretary Rumsfeld, others saying, it's not me.
No, not everybody, though.
Not everybody. Not everybody.
We haven't heard from the Vice President.
The most important person we haven't heard from, and I take it, George, you're asking me this question because Bob Woodward and I work for the same company, is Richard Armitage, former Deputy Secretary of State, which actually complicates the matter even further, because the neat line of division in this story was that the neoconservatives centered around Cheney and Rumsfeld were doing this to discredit the CIA and the State Department. But if Armitage, who was Colin Powell's deputy and a sworn foe of the Cheney-Rumsfeld axis, is doing this, then it does begin to seem just like gossip that was being bandied around.
Exactly right.
Libby was indicted for lying, ostensibly and implicitly lying, to cover up a protracted campaign to release this information centered in the vice president's office. But what Woodward says is that twice in late June 2003, he met with Mr. Libby, and Mr. Libby never mentioned it. Now, that was a
even though he's on his notes as a possible question.
On the notes of his as Woodward, yes. Now, that's a pretty lethargic campaign. If he meets twice with this reliable conduit of information, Mr. Woodward, and doesn't mention
it. But does this help Mr. Libby's legal case?
Well, it seems to, but we don't know very much about this. There are tons of things we don't know. We don't know who Woodward's source is. We don't know who Robert Novak's source was.
Could be the same person.
Yeah. Could be, or it could be other people.
The timeline doesn't really change that, but I mean, it's as you said. I mean, Louis Libby is up for lying.
If the country is losing interest in Judge Alito, I have a feeling it is rapidly losing interest in the next.
Well, then just in time, because we're out of time today. Thank you all very much. Our voice this week, Ted Koppel. For more than 40 years, Ted has covered everything for ABC. All the way back to 1964, when he first sharpened his campaign chops, covering Barry Goldwater with another cub reporter from ABC named Peter Jennings. On Tuesday, Ted will host his final Nightline. And before he goes, we asked him to reminisce about his most memorable political interviews. Gary Hart led the list.
The Gary Hart adventure, or romantic adventure, is becoming a part of the presidential campaign. Was really the first time that had ever happened. And I remember in particular something that Gary Hart said to me during the course of the interview, to the effect that he was prepared to answer the question, but hoped it would never, ever be asked of another candidate again. Did you have an affair with me, Russ?
I don't care what questions are asked, tonight or any time in the future. I'm not going to answer them on any specific instance. Now, I've been forced to make a declaration here that I think is unprecedented in American political history, and I regret it. That question should never have been asked, and I shouldn't have to answer it.
It was a terribly awkward question, but there was no way of doing that particular interview without asking it, because it had become the central issue of his candidacy. Mike Dukakis, of course, was at the very end of his presidential campaign. This was 2 weeks away from Election Day. He was way behind in the polls. And this was an opportunity to, if not turn things around entirely, at least close the gap. It ended up being a total disaster for the Dukakis campaign.
With all due respect, let me suggest to you, I still don't think you get it.
I was saying to him, Governor, you know, here's a chance to get a network audience for 1 hour in which you are being asked questions. And he kept saying the same things he'd been saying in the campaign throughout. I didn't mean it to be rude, but it came out that way. And he missed that opportunity, too. If Mike Dukakis was not good at responding to difficult questions, Bill Clinton was brilliant at it.
I will appear on Nightline tonight to discuss all of this in greater detail.
All of this is the controversy over Bill Clinton's draft record. And this 22-year-old letter obtained by Nightline, in which Clinton writes, no government should have the power to make its citizens fight and kill and die in a war they oppose. I was concerned that this letter might be a phony. And so I invited him to come on the program that night. And this is where Bill Clinton showed his stuff.
It is a letter of a deeply agitated 23-year-old boy. A young man. At least I was involved in the issues of my time.
He is one of the world's best handlers of the media. I think when historians look back on these last 25 years, one of their observations may well be that politicians, particularly presidential candidates, who did well in handling television, were able to overcome what looked like almost fatal setbacks, whereas those who could not ended up failing as much as anything else because of their inability to master the media.
And no one has mastered this medium quite like Ted. We're going to miss him. Now, the Sunday funnies.
Let's begin in Washington. Yesterday, the Senate approved a measure requiring the president issue quarterly reports outlining the progress being made in Iraq. Wow! That means they'll get to hear how the war is going like four times a year. It's like a report card if you went to Fiasco Junior High.
President Bush, his Supreme Court nominee, taking a lot of heat. Yeah, they're scrutinizing everything. This week's Supreme Court nominee, Samuel Alito, said he's embarrassed by some of the things he wrote in the 1980s. Yeah. Yeah, it turns out Alito wrote the song, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go.
Then the president got specific.
Many of these critics supported my opponent during the last election to explain his position to support the resolution in the Congress this way. When I vote to give the President of the United States the authority to use force, if necessary, to disarm Saddam Hussein, it is because I believe...
God! Kerry's boring even when Bush is reading him.
Let's say you're shopping for a new flat screen, because maybe you're a TV fanatic and you need one to feel truly happy. Here are two models. Similar specs, similar image quality, same TV basically, except one's got a huge price tag. You pick the better value, right? You may be a TV fanatic, but you're not crazy. So, if you wouldn't overpay for a TV, why would you overpay for high-speed internet? Get all the speed you need, cheaper than most cable, with Verizon Online DSL. It's the best value in broadband.